Thanks so much for coming. My name is Emily Parker. So before I introduce Evelyn to everybody, I just wanted to give a quick shout out to a supporter of this program, which is PICO. So thank you, PICO, for supporting this program today. And Evelyn, I'd like to bring you on up to the podium. Thank you so much.
First of all, I'm excited to be here, very, very excited to see all of your beautiful faces. This made me feel, I'm almost in tears, actually. Whenever I see a whole bunch of children, it just makes me want to cry with joy because I know that you are the future that we wait for. And so I'm so excited. I want to thank the Rosenbach for bringing me here today in the Free Library, for allowing me to be in their beautiful auditorium. And to all their staff here and the staff at the Rosenbach, Emily Parker, who has been just so kind to me from the very first time I had an email from her. I just feel like she's like a sister to me now. I want to thank you all from the Masterman School. I looked at your school website, which was really exciting. And what I learned from that website is that I was going to be speaking to some brilliant young scholars. And that made me so happy because that means that whatever I say today, you learn from me, I know that you will take it back and you will take something with you and change the world. I know that you'll do that. So when I see the world begin to change, I'll know that some of the Masterman people and students and the wonderful teachers there have helped the world to move forward just from reading your website. So now that I get to be in your energy and get to see all of your faces and hug some of you, I feel at peace. I really do, because I know the world is changing in the right direction. I'm going to be talking today about the Freedom Train. Now, I consider myself a person who knows a lot about history. When I was in the third grade, a teacher asked me a question one day, close to the end of school, and I didn't know the answer. And some of the kids snickered. Well, I said to myself, this will never happen to me again. So that summer, I read our set of encyclopedias from A to Z. Of course, it has still happened to me again, but at that time in my third grade knowledge, I thought that once I read the encyclopedia from cover to cover, I would know everything. But I don't know hardly anything, even now at almost 70 years old. Yesterday, I found out something about an F and an S that I never knew. So I called my husband last night, who's an Indo-European linguist, and I said to him, I said, how could I have missed that? He was like, honey, there are a lot of people who don't know that. So that made me feel a little bit better. But I love history. So when these are some of the books I've written, and I'm told that you've read some of, heard some of them, To Be a Drum, with James Earl Jones reading it online. White Sox Only, which is one of my favorite books of all time. The Addie book, I wrote the Addie Doll's first mystery. It's called Shadows on Society Hill. And there she is. And I have to tell you, when I started writing her, some of your questions have to do with me as a writer. When I started writing, her story already existed. There had been six other books written about her, so I needed to follow her life plan and come up with a new story. And for some reason, I just could not grasp who she was as a character. So I finally decided the only way I'd be able to do it is to sleep with her. So she started sleeping in the bed with us. Now, if you've ever seen this doll, she has some really hard little feet. Because she's made out of hard plastic. And my husband would just beg me to please put her in, don't put her in the middle, put her on your side. Because her feet are pumping my back. But she slept with me for about 3 months, and finally I began to understand who she was as a character to put her in a story. So that's how that story. Now, Freedom Train was brought to me by the Savannah College of Art. They had approached me to write Freedom Train as a picture book. And so for about 6 months, I tried to do that, and I failed miserably. I kept writing and writing, and it was just so boring, I didn't know what to do. And I said, okay, this is not going to work. But I had never heard of the Freedom Train, and when they first approached me, the only Freedom Train I knew anything about was during our enslavement period, the period when we were Underground Railroad. So I think, I don't want to write about that. There are lots of books about Freedom Train. And they said, no, there's no book about the train that traveled the United States in 1947 through 1949. And I was like, are you talking about a real train? And they were like, yes. So this train traveled the United States. Almost 4 million people actually got on this train and signed a pledge to democracy. And it had the original, not copies, but the original documents on it, which was fascinating to me. So as I learned about this train, I was so fascinated. I finally decided what I needed to do was to really look into how I could make a character that cared about freedom and democracy in 1947. Now, at that time, black people in the United States were still suffering under Jim Crow laws, which mean we couldn't go in stores and eat, we couldn't shop in certain department stores, we couldn't drink out of water fountains. There were all kinds of things that black people could not do. So I could not imagine why a black child would even care about the Freedom Train at that point. So I ended up thinking, who would care about democracy and freedom, but yet still have to struggle? And I decided to use a community in Atlanta, Georgia, called Cabbage Town, because it was a place where poor people that were white who had moved from the Appalachian Mountains into Georgia worked for a cotton mill. And they were really, really discriminated against in Atlanta, Georgia. So I went to those people to learn their story. Now, this is the train. The train was absolutely beautiful. It was remodeled and repackaged to be a real train, red, white, and blue. And I love it. And it had the Emancipation Proclamation on it. It had all kinds of documents. It went to 322 cities in the United States. And this is a map that they actually sold this map as like a gift. Now, this is the thing. We always think of branding as modern. You know, when people start branding, you know, everything, it was a modern thing. But the people who founded the Freedom Train, they were called the Heritage Foundation. They understood branding in a way that you wouldn't even understand it now. They actually had leather cases with this map on it. I mean, it was amazing. On this train, they had the letter of Columbus saying that he had discovered America. They had the Magna Carta on this train. I mean, it was amazing. They even built these compartments to hold the documents that would control humidity and those kinds of things so that the documents could survive on the train for the 3 years that it traveled the United States. Now, these are some of my favorite pictures. On this train, the train over time was guarded by 50 Marines, but initially there were 28 Marines chosen, and they were chosen by their looks and their height. We're talking Brandon for real. So they had to be a certain height and they had to have a certain look. And literally, they were gorgeous men. They lived on this train for those 3 years for the most part. They had a doctor on this train. And the train, when they went to different cities, they were treated like celebrities. Now, on this train, three black porters actually served on the train. In order to get on the train, you had to sign a pledge of freedom to get on the train. And here they had celebrities coming to visit the train. And Lana Turner was a very famous woman, actress at that time. So you can see just by looking at all the things. And this is the song that we were playing for you when you came in. Now, I had heard this song before. If you've heard this song and recognize this tune, raise your hand.
This song is a train song. It's a song about a train.
Not the Atchison, Topeka.
All right, I see a lot of hands. That's good. I see young kids' hands, too. That's amazing. I thought all the adults' hands would go up, but I see some of the children's hands. That's great. Okay, the Freedom Train, that song was written by a famous composer, Irving Berlin. And it was performed by the Andrews Sisters and Bing Crosby. Now, when I was a little girl, my father was a big fan of Bing Crosby and the Andrews Sisters, so we had a lot of their recordings. And I had heard that song ever since I was a little girl, but I had no idea it was about a real train, none whatsoever. But if you listen to the words, it talks about democracy, it talks about freedom, it talks about fighting for democracy. And all that time, even though I knew some of the lyrics, it never occurred to me that there was a real train traveling the United States at that time this song became popular. They even had a freedom prayer that people would say before they got on the train. And they would have these big, elaborate celebrations about the train. Now, Superman even got in on the train. Captain Marvel, I mean, not Superman, he looks like Superman, but he was Captain Marvel. They made 16 comic books, stories about the Freedom Train, and this Captain Marvel is saving the Freedom Train in this story. Now, I actually bought this comic book so that I would have it. So the Freedom Train, the other thing was a group of Girl Scouts, Brownie Scouts at the time, went to see the Freedom Train, and they all decided to put on lipstick, and they all kissed the train. Now, this made the train authorities very unhappy, because in the end, they couldn't wipe off the lipstick, so they had to repaint the part of the train that all these little girls had kissed. Now, I can't imagine why they thought they should kiss the train. I can't explain that part. Now, in the story, my protagonist, the hero of my story, is named Clyde Thomason. Now, this little boy that I saw in a newspaper clipping was my inspiration. He's the second in line with the leather jacket on. I just fell in love with that little boy. And he just thought, I would just, like days, I would just stare at his face and think, what would he be doing? What would he be saying? And he is how I came up with Clyde Thomason. And one day, I wish I could find this young man, but his name wasn't written in the paper that I got this clip from. But one day, I hope he'll see his picture in the back of the book and realizes him and contact me. Now, the little boy in the story, William Dobbs III, who is called the Third William, my inspiration was this young man with the hat on in the front. I was like, wow, he is dressed so cool. And so I decided to make him the friend to Clyde Thomason. Now, these are some of the pictures. Look at all these people who went to see it. And this is some on the train. The Marines would help guide the people through the train. Now, at the time, when I'm working, when I'm writing a story that's historical in nature, something that really happened, I spend a lot of time doing research. I spent a year doing research about the Freedom Train. And during that time, I have to find out what kind of toys were available in 1947, 1948, and 1949. I know what kind of music was playing in the background of people's homes. I know what kind of furniture they use. I look at how much things cost. I know how much clothes cost, how much food costs. I look at what kind of flora, fauna grows, what kind of trees are growing in the area, what kind of policing is done, what kind of work is being done by most of the people. So I spend a lot of time researching. And this is what I had to do for the Freedom Train. I went to the FBI, which is called Open Records, and requested any records they had about the Freedom Train, and got I got a box of records this big talking about the Freedom Train. But much of it was called redacted papers, and that's where they erase
some of the words, like the people's names that are involved and all kinds of things like that. So I wanted you to see what redacted papers look like. When you're doing research for your work, for your books or your essays, you'll be able eventually to have these redacted papers, and you'll know why you have these blank spaces. They also did all kinds of writing about the Freedom Train at that time. It was in the newspaper in every city that the Freedom Train visited. Now, there was a lot of discrimination going on, and the problem came. There was a man, a poet named Langston Hughes. He wrote a poem. Oh, you recognize his name. That's wonderful. He wrote a poem called The Freedom Train. And actually, I knew that poem, but I didn't know it was about this train until I started my research. He wrote this poem because he was wondering how a freedom train could cross the Mason-Dixon line and then have segregated lines to come and visit the train. In some cities, in some southern cities, they didn't even want the black people to even be able to come on the train at all. And then in some cities, they decided they would have separate segregated lines. So they would have the white people in one line and the black people in another. Well, eventually, after Langston Hughes' poem and other people protesting, eventually, the Heritage Foundation, the people who funded the train, decided that the train would not stop in any city that was requiring segregation. So all the southern mayors got together, not all of them, but most of them, and said, well, we won't have the train visit then because we're not going to integrate our lines. Now, Mayor Hartsfield, who was the mayor of Atlanta, Georgia, for some reason, and I've read all his diaries and his own personal papers, and I still don't know why he decided to go against the other southern mayors, but he decided to allow integrated lines when people in Atlanta, Georgia saw the train. So a few other southern mayors followed his lead. And so when the train came to Atlanta, he was able to have integrated lines viewing the train. And as you'll see when you read Freedom Train, the book that I wrote, you'll understand the dynamic of that story. Now, this was the most exciting part of writing this book for me. The Marines, some of the Marines who guarded that train were still living right now. So I was able to talk to them and to get their stories and to get to information as to what they did every day on the train, how they maneuvered on the train, what it was like to be a celebrity in different cities when you got there, and all kinds of information. So these are six of the men who served as Marines on the Freedom Train here. This is a picture where they have a reunion still and get together. Now, this is them at the memorial where they got together in 67. And this is Mr. John A. Brown. He was one of the Marines that I fell in love with. I was telling Ms. Parker, when I called him on the phone, he lived in California, his voice was so beautiful. I said, oh, I must have the wrong number. I must have dialed a radio station. I'm sorry. And he was like, who are you trying to find? And I said, Mr. John Brown. And he was like, that's me. And I said, are you on a microphone? He was like, no. I said, do you work in a radio station? No. He said, but everybody thinks I do. He had the most gorgeous voice I have ever heard. I would call him up every other day just to hear his voice. And we became very good friends. And that's when he was a young man, just before he decided to get married, right from the time he was leaving the Freedom Train. And this is the Marines all together sitting at a banquet together. Don't they look great? Yes, yeah, so that's pretty much the research that I've done. Now I'm going to go through some of your questions. One of the questions that you asked me is, how long do you write each day? Well, I'm a person that I believe in the flow of my energy. So I just do whatever I want to each day. So I don't write every day. Sometimes I've gone like 3 years now without writing anything. I mostly spend my time watching Korean dramas and telling myself that I'm doing this because I'm adapting to a new writing style. But that's the only way I can convince myself that I'm not wasting time. How long does it take you to write a full book? Now, this is a puzzle. When I write a picture book usually is about 3 to no more than 10 double-spaced pages. When I write a picture book, it takes me about 3 to 5 years. I've never written a picture book that I have published that didn't take me three to five years, not ever. Now, an adult book takes me about a year. A middle grade book takes me about a year and a half to 2 years. Now, the thing about you is this. This is what I wanted. This is a gift I'm going to give you, and I want you to try it just once. You don't have to do it every time, but try it just once to see if it'll work for you like it works for me. When I write a book, I don't care how many pages it is. It could be 500 pages. When I'm finished and I think I have everything perfect just the way I want it, I tear it up. I know. It's drastic, but I'm a drastic person. I tear it up and I start over. Now, I learned this, the way I learned this secret. When I started a book for years, I would go to a monastery where they did not talk. It was a silent monastery. And I would go to this monastery because I like to talk. And so if I'm home, I'm talking to my kids or my husband or somebody, my friends, but I'm constantly engaged in conversation with someone. So if at this monastery, because there is no talking, I could get a lot done. So I would go there for a couple of weeks and I would write nonstop. I would have 3 meals a day. I would take 2 walks a day. Now, here's the thing. The monastery, the monks cooked the food. They were terrible cooks, so you would never overeat. You just have those 3 meals and not desire it, not even a morsel more, because you'd have to make yourself eat that meal. Not one of them, even though 3 of them were Italians, could cook good food. I mean, it was just awful. But I would go there and I would write. So I'm there for 1 week, and I've written like 300 pages. I'm so excited. I have it just the way I want it. Now, this was a long time ago, and it was when you had to go to DOS, and which you don't even know what that is, to find in a computer, to find your work if it got lost. So about 3 o'clock in the morning, when I've finished, I've written the end at the end of my story. I'm sitting there grinning to myself like crazy, and it disappears. I have no idea where it went. I go to my DOS, and I cannot find it. I'm literally hysterical by now. I'm crying. So the monks they don't have telephones there for people to use, and the only payphone is down in the crypt where the deceased monks are laying. In a basement. So you have to be really committed at 3 o'clock in the morning to want to make a phone call. So I'm so hysterical by this time that I go down there shaking in fear and call my husband crying like a lunatic. And I say, I don't know what happened. I lost everything that was in there. And I can't find it. I've looked through it. And my husband is so quiet and peaceful a person. He just listened to me for a while. And then he said, honey, it's okay. You're a writer. Just start over. I was like, now, why didn't I think of that? So I went upstairs, and I started over, and believe me, I was amazed, even though I came up with a whole nother story that wasn't in any way similar to what I had written before, it was 150% better than what I had written before. So this is what I want you to try. The next time you have an assignment, an essay, or something, a composition that you need to write, I want you to work on it until you get it perfect, just the way you want to turn it in. And then I want you to tear it up and start all over. How many of you think you can do that? Yay! Okay. Believe me, all this buzz is not uncommon. When I said this to a group of writers once, they all took a deep breath and cried almost. So your reaction is really apropos. Okay. What made you want to write about American Girl dolls? Actually, I didn't really want to write about American Girl dolls. The American Girl Company approached me first, asking me to write a story for them. And at first I declined because I would be writing behind another writer, and I don't really want to do that. And so eventually they approached me about writing something that they had called History Mysteries. So the first books I wrote for them were the mystery books that they have, and which I loved writing, by the way. What made you start wanting to write, and do you like it? Now, that's a really loaded question. I decided that I wanted to write when I was about your age. I loved reading and writing when I was a kid. But my father told me when I was in the sixth grade, he said, "It's wonderful that you want to be a writer." He said, "I can tell you, writers can change the world, and they don't even have to meet the people in person." He said, "It's amazing." He said, "Do you know that in many countries, when dictators take over, they kill the writers first?" I was like, that is not a pro approach to me wanting to be a writer. I think I will bypass this till later. So at that point, I just said, no, I don't want to be a writer, because if they think they're going to kill the writers first, I don't want to go there. So no, I'm not going to be a writer. So it wasn't until I was 45 years old. I had been a psychotherapist and a hypnotherapist for 13 years that I decided to become a writer. So it was a long time coming. Now, being a writer, do I like it? It is the most painstaking, gut-wrenching, scary thing I ever do. But it's also one of the most rewarding things I do. But it doesn't get rewarding until I'm with people like you who have either seen my work or read my work or will be reading my work, and then I feel comfortable. But when I'm writing, a picture book can make me cry completely. Like, I have literally laid on the floor crying over a picture book. I mean, that's how hard it had gotten. When I wrote Shadows on Society Hill, I actually tried to give American Girl the money back because I felt like I could not finish that book. I wrote that book, 400 pages. When I finished it, I sent it to my youngest daughter, who is my reader for me. She's a tough young lady. She called me up and she said, "Mom, are you working for a pharmaceutical company now?" I said, "A pharmaceutical company? No, why would you ask me that?" She said, "This thing put me to sleep so fast." I said she was tough. So I did, you know what I did? I tore it up and I started over. You know how many times I tore that book up? 3 different times. I wrote 300 pages, tore them up, and started over 3 different times. That's 900 pages just to make one book. Okay. The next question is, Do you spend a lot of time on the road trying to find inspiration? No, actually, I find inspiration just reading or watching people or researching. I'm inspired by anything. Anything makes me inspired. I can be so happy. One time I was riding down the street in Atlanta, Georgia, and I looked over to my right at a stoplight and saw these people doing something in this glass front building. And I didn't know what they were doing at first, so I pulled over because I was like, what are they doing? When I realized that they were making candy, I was in my car going, ah, they're making candy, oh my God. They saw me through the window. I don't know if they thought I was having a fit or what. Some of them came to the window, and finally they came to the door and said, ma'am, are you all right? And I was like, I am ecstatic. I said, you all are in there making candy. I've never seen this before. They said, you can come in. And so I went in and made friends with them, and boy, did I have a lot of free candy after that. I can tell you. The question is, who is my favorite author? I love so many books, so many authors. I don't really have a favorite author, but my favorite book is written by an English author, actually, and it's about a little boy who doesn't really think that his mother's being nice to him. And it's called I'll Take You to Mrs. Cole. And there's this woman in the block that everybody's scared of. And she has a lot of kids, and their house is all rickety. And so when the mother gets mad at the kids, she says, if you don't stop doing that, I'm going to take you to Mrs. Cole. And boy, when he decides one day to just go to Mrs. Cole's. He was that mad at his mother. And when he gets there, he just loves Mrs. Cole. So, of course, the next time his mother threatens to take him to Mrs. Cole, he's all ready to go. I love that book. I just love it. Is it hard to find a publisher for your books? No, it was not hard for me to find a publisher, even though most authors say it's a very tough thing to find a publisher. This is why it was not hard for me to find a publisher. And if you hear nothing else I say, I hope you can hear this. When I do anything, when I start doing anything, I do my homework first. So when I began to decide that I was going to be a writer, I bought every writing book there is. I started taking classes about writing. I immersed myself in the world of writing and publication. I studied publishers on a regular basis every day. And eventually, when I decided, it took me 2 years to even move myself to think that I knew enough to approach a publisher. So from the first time I ever approached a publisher, I got a positive response. But that's because I do everything that way. But I'm obsessive, compulsive person that knows how to direct my energy, pretty much. Who was my role model growing up? My parents. I loved my parents when I was growing up. I loved how smart they were. I loved how kind they were, how thoughtful they were. So I'd say my parents. Does your childhood influence your writing? Absolutely. My childhood does influence my writing. I had one of the most idyllic, rich, kind, thoughtful childhoods any child could have. I grew up on the street with my whole family. All my mother's family lived on one street, one house, each a house apart. And until I was 13 years old, my brother and I were the only children in this large extended family. So we were nurtured from the day we were born to now by that family. So, yes. Do you keep a writer's notebook? Lord, no. I cannot read my writing under any circumstances. I have two stories now that I wrote by hand that it had 10 years later, I still can't decipher what it says. How many books do you own? My husband and I own literally thousands of books. What is your favorite book you wrote? It's hard to say my favorite book that I wrote, really. I love all of them in some way. But there was another question that I've actually never been asked before. It says, do you want each of your books to stand on its own, or are you trying to build a body of work with connections between each book? That is an amazing question. No one's ever asked me that question, not a child or an adult. I want each of my books to stand on their own. But the one thing that is through every book that I write is justice. When I was a child, from as early as I can remember, I cared about things being just and fair. My mother used to have to bring a ruler to the table because when she cut the pie or the cake, I wanted my brother and I to have identical, fair slices. And so I was always concerned with things like that. What's your favorite? Nobody's ever asked me this question either. What's your favorite underappreciated novel? That's an amazing question from a child. My favorite underappreciated novel is probably Freedom Train. I really think it deserves more attention just because of what is happening in the world today. I think it's just an incredible way to look at books. How much of the books are true or happened to you, especially The Chicken Man? So that means you've read White Sox Only. The Chicken Man is like a myth from black culture. So he's not real, but I always tell children if he was real, there would be a whole lot of clucking going on. So no, there's no real Chicken Man that I know. That was a mythology that's in black culture. Let's see, the last one. Does writing energize or exhaust you? Both. It does both. Now, I'm going to tell you the one last thing, because I can see Ms. Parker coming to the front, so that means my time is up. But this is the one last thing I'm going to say. To be a drum, I don't know if you were able to hear James Earl Jones read that story. If you didn't, I hope you will. And I will tell you how To Be a Drum came to be. When we were young, my father would take us out into the back fields of our house, and we would lie down with him, and he would tell us to relax. He would say, relax your arms, relax your legs, relax your body. Just relax like you're floating in the water. And so we would relax, my brother and I, and then he would say, now put your ear to the ground and listen, and what do you hear? And we would put our ear to the ground and we would hear bump, 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 bump. And then he'd say, you know what that is? That is the sound of the earth's heart beating. He said, and guess what? If you put your hand up to your chest and be real, real still, you can feel that same earth heartbeat inside your body. And so we would do that. And then he'd say, now hold your hand on my chest and see if you feel that. And we would feel our father's chest and it would feel just like the earth's heartbeat. And then he would say, do you know what that means to you? It means that as long as you're alive, every human being that you meet, every person that you meet has that same heartbeat in their body. That means you can never disrespect another human being. You can never be mean.